This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.
Okay, we're live, Mike.
Here we go. Welcome, everyone, to Ages and Icons. I'm Mike Crisologo.
And I'm Gina Bucci. You're a bit hot there, Mike, on the mic. Oh. Mike on the mic.
Yeah, it's been a long day, hasn't it? We've been running back and forth. We just got into the studio. We just came from an interview with the one and only Michael Palin.
Michael Palin. Yeah,
former Monty Python member, author, traveler extraordinaire. He's made what's the words I'm looking for here, Gina? Travel documentaries?
Duties? That's travel documentaries.
We literally just ran into the studio, hooked it up, and started going. So Michael Palin.
He would appreciate that joke.
Yeah.
It's very lowbrow. After all, he is the guy that came up with the coconuts joke on Holy Grail, right?
Holy Grail. I have had the Lumberjack song stuck in my head for the last 2 days, reading about Michael Palin.
Sing a little. Free it. Free it from your brain.
I'm a lumberjack and I'm okay. I drink all night and I work all day.
Okay, it's going to be in all of our heads.
I'm not sure, yeah, but...
It's going to be in every listener's head for the foreseeable future.
I'm a huge Monty Python fan, as I have bored Gina with in the car for the last couple of hours.
Oh, Mike, you know what? But... Don't take the yawning personally. It's just, okay, fine, then you can. No, I like Monty Python a lot, too. I'm not a huge Python head, as many people are, but I certainly appreciate them.
Yeah, and I mean, Michael Palin is... obviously one of the key members and a founder, but I mean, when you think of some of the great sketches, from the dead parrot sketch to the fish slapping dance to, I mean, there was the great sketch of the mountain climbers in an office. And I mean, he was joking in our interview about playing Biggest Dickus or playing the emperor, talking about Biggest Dickus. And, he's been in some of the seminal like Monty Python sketches and the Lumberjack song, which is why I have it in my head.
Mike has this ability to turn off his fanboydom. So fanboydom, whatever.
I try, but you know what?
You did it. So when you interviewed him, like, you really became a professional interviewer. He didn't even ask for an autograph, which I totally would have. I told you, this is why I cannot meet my heroes. But Mike, surprisingly, like, functions very well in front of his.
Yeah, inside I was all, ee! But outwardly I was totally cool, I think. But
not a skill I possess, Mike. Good for you.
But you know, the Monty Python actually segues into what we're there to talk to him about, because he writes in his new book, which is called Erebus, that he was on stage with the rest of the Python, minus Graham Chapman, of course, in 2014. And they had done those giant shows in the O2 Arena in London. 200,000 people came and saw them. And he mentions in the intro to this book that it left him almost in an anticlimactic state. He was longing for something more, for an adventure, for something different, instead of just doing the parrot sketch again, the lumberjack song again. And that's how, partly how we ended up with this book called Erebus, One Ship, Two Epic Voyages, and the Greatest Naval Mystery of All Time.
And it's nonfiction.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No. Michael Palin's had a whole second act as an explorer, as a travel journalist of sorts, making documentaries, traveling all over the world. We talked about this in the interview, that he worked more as a travel documentarian, can't even talk today, a travel documentarian, than he has as a member of Monty Python. Mm-hmm. Like, his travel part of his career has been more than Monty Python.
And he loves it. He says it gives him like new life.
Exactly. Yeah. And he's been doing it for 30 years. And I mean, for those who don't know about the book, it's called, like I said, Erebus, and it's about the Erebus ship. And it's a fascinating sort of 19th century tale of this ship that took a voyage down to the Antarctic and was exploring the Antarctic. And then it was one of the ships on the Franklin expedition, which is sort of the heart of the story, the Franklin expedition that was going up to try to find the Northwest Passage. And of course, they didn't, and they all died, and the ships were way off course. That, and it's the other ship that was with them, the Terror, which is, as a side note, do you want to be riding on it, like, especially in like the 19th century with a scurvy?
I wouldn't even want to be traveling with the Terror.
Yeah, you want to be on the Terror
ship? No.
Yeah, exactly.
The Terror.
Can you imagine?
Who named this
what's the name
ship?
Of our ship? Oh, it's called the Terror. Yeah, don't worry. It'll be fine.
Well, I mean, what were their choices back then, right? This is the 1800s.
Anything.
Scurvy.
Yeah. Yeah, like anything other than terror. Like, I guess the other ship.
The famine. Like, I mean,
yeah,
rather
exactly.
Ride the
yeah,
famine.
I guess the horror was out of commission by then, so they took the Erebus. And anyway, the Erebus and the Terror went off course, and the Franklin Expedition, they all died, and they never actually sort of reached and found the Northwest Passage. And in recent years, I forget, I think it was 2015, but I could be wrong. The ships were found in the Canadian Arctic. Mm-hmm. And Stephen Harper, Prime Minister Stephen Harper at the time, he made the announcement. And that was one of the things that sort of caught Michael Palin's interest and caught his eye and made him want to learn more about this ship. And from there, he traveled the same routes up down to Antarctica, up through the Canadian Arctic to retrace the, I don't know if you call it retracing steps when it's a ship, retrace the waves.
The waves, yeah.
Retrace the waves of the Erebus and learn about this ship that we don't know a ton about and learn about what happened to these men on this ship and their fates. And there's still so many mysteries we don't know about the Franklin Expedition and how it failed and why it failed. But, you know, Michael Palin, he writes this book in incredible detail. It's been getting rave reviews. He's got little bits of humor in there as well, you know, when you're reading it. So it's really a fascinating
account. Well, that's probably why he chose it, because there's some accounts such as they built a pub on the ship.
No, they built it when they were stranded in the ice. They built a pub out of the ice for New Year's. That's what we talk about in the interview where it's like only the essentials, right? They built a pub, not lodgings, not another ship or something to get out of there. we'll just build a pub. So I mean, we were there.
Probably what gravitated him toward the topic.
Right. So we were there to talk about the Erebus, but of course we talked a little bit about Monty Python as well. And he was every bit of the gentleman and the kind man that everybody says he was. And it was a thrill to interview Michael Palin.
Okay, well, before we get to Mike's interview, a little housekeeping. Follow us on everythingzoomer.com where Mike's articles are there, my videos are there, this podcast resides there, ages and icons.
Other people have articles and stuff there too.
Do so they? I don't read it.
Everythingmikeandgina.com.
That's it, yeah. Also known as everythingzoomer.com. And, of course, you can follow and subscribe us and listen to us on iTunes. Let's see. We're on Stitcher. Oh, we are now on Spotify. So look for us there. And that's about it. Oh, yeah. Let's jump into the interview. That's why we're here. Here's Mike's interview with Michael Palin.
Okay.
We're good?
Yeah, we're all
set. Okay, well, I mean, I have so many questions, so I'll just jump right in.
Far away. I will try and give you some answers. Yeah.
The Erebus, the book. Yeah. First of all, am I pronouncing that right? Erebus?
Yeah, Erebus is right. Okay. Yeah.
We had some debates with it. Erebus or Erebus.
Yeah,
so.
I know. It's been a problem, actually. I don't know how to address that. Yeah. Just change it. Erybus. But it's Erebus, yeah.
Perfect. So, I mean, it's a fascinating story, obviously, traveling to the Antarctic and then traveling up with the Franklin Expedition to find the Northwest Passage. But as the writer of the book who got to do that same sort of trip in your research, what was that like to sort of retrace the steps?
It was quite oddly moving in parts because I'd read a lot about the people. And my book about the ship is also very much about the people on board the ship and what sort of people they were and trying to glean any information from their diaries, their letters, what it might have been like. So going to some of the places where they had, important places where they spent time, there was definitely a kind of little quickening of the blood when I was there and seeing the lighthouse in Tasmania. There's a long estuary that leads up to Hobart, which is very, very important for their ships and when they went to the Antarctic. And they all mentioned this lighthouse called the Tin Pot Lighthouse. And the Tin Pot Lighthouse is still there. And it was just quite something to be down in Tasmania, looking out to sea. There's no land before you get to Antarctica. Yeah. And there's the Tin Pot Lighthouse still winking away as it had for them. That was great, yeah.
And you mentioned that a lot of the book, of course, is about the people on the ship. And yes. That was one of the sort of fascinating things, because there's so many mysteries associated with this story still. Like, what happened to Franklin and a lot of his men, how they died, how the ships ended up so off course. And there was the Pegler Papers, which you called sort of an enigma.
Yeah.
Where if you read the book, you understand, like, this could explain a lot.
Yeah.
So for yourself, I mean, obviously as the writer, there's some mysteries you just can't explain. If you could have one of those explained, which one would you love to just sort of know the answer to?
Well, I'd love to know what went on in the ship, the Erebus, after Franklin died. Because he kind of up to that point, everything, there's the one record, the Victory Point note, has a little thing saying it's 1847, all well, Sir John Franklin commanding, and it's underlined the all well. Within 11 months, everything had changed. That note had been rewritten around the outside. Franklin had died a week after the all was well. 15 men and 9 officers had died in that time. What happened? Was there an outbreak of scurvy on board the ship? How were the decisions taken to eventually abandon the ship? And, you know, what was Franklin's position at that time? Was he in a strong enough position to tell them, look, if I get sick, you've got to do this, you've got to do that? So that little, what happened in that little period in the latter half of 1847, I'd love to have been a fly on the wall or a polar bear in the water or whatever, out there.
Do you find when you're writing a book like this, that humor helps to convey the story to the readers? Because I noticed that it's not a humorous book per se. It's not a comedy book, but there is humor in it. And I don't know if that's just you that's your personality, or if it also helps convey the story a bit better.
No, I always search out the humor in everything, really. Yeah. I mean, if I can't find humor somewhere, then I kind of not so interested. And I think it's something that's beginning to be, people are becoming aware now. Like, there's a lot of celebrations in Britain at the moment, commemorations of what happened in the First World War. And you just know all these terrible pictures of people going out of the trenches and being shot and all that. And yet, it's now known that there was a great, you know, in order to survive this, a great deal of humor, a great deal of comradeliness in the face of the awfulness of what they had to do. And the same on Erebus and Terror. I think there was a great comradeliness amongst the people there, you know, and it must have been, and we know that they, on New Year's Day 1842, they carved an 8-foot woman out of the ice in the Antarctic, and they built a pub, and they made a dance floor, and they had a party, you know? So this doesn't sound like people who were terrified of the ice and darkness. Maybe they were, but that was their way of dealing with it. So humor is also the way in which people relax, I think, and you can get an account with humor in it is always worth twice as much as a formal account.
I love that they built a pub, like that's the thing that was the essential thing for them there. It's like a pub, not a house or a lodging.
I know, not a laboratory. I love that. It's, and they had ice creams on the... the further south than anyone's ever been, and they hand out ice cream. Just fantastic.
Now, it's really interesting to me that you sort of started this second career traveling and writing and doing television shows about travel. Yeah. You mentioned that in an interview I read that you really first traveled the world when you were 45. Which is interesting because our Zoomer magazine, where we're from, is for the 45 and up demographic. And we talk about second acts a lot. And this was really a second act for you in your life.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I mean, you've almost been, correct me if I'm wrong, but you've been like sort of doing travel work longer than you did Monty Python.
Oh, yeah.
You were originally sort of known for.
No, exactly. Much longer. Yeah.
So, I mean, what has that meant for you to be able to spend the last 30 years traveling the world and exploring these mysteries and telling these stories?
It has been terrific. I mean, it's really, I wouldn't say it's given me a new lease of life, because I always had a lease of life. I always had an appetite for doing things. But, doing television, making movies, appears very glamorous, but actually it's studios. It's, you know, being picked up at 5 in the morning to go and spend a day doing nothing and then taken back and all that. So suddenly being able to travel, and the way I did, and have to report back, suddenly opened, cliche, but opened the horizons. It suddenly made me feel, hey, physically and you know, intellectually, a bit more stimulated at a time when some people are saying, oh, well, it's the second half of your life, you know, midlife crisis and all that. For me, no, it was the start of something new, which has really invigorated me since. And I mean, you can tell the way I talk about the books and their travels. I'm still enormously interested in the rest of the world and what it's like. And I'm just a restless soul. And I think a lot of people are. Some aren't. Some are quite happy. My wife, for instance, is happier to stay at home. I'm a restless soul, which is probably why we've been married for 52 years.
Wow. And would you equate the ability to travel and just sort of get out and see the world? Is there an equation between that and just sort of aging in a healthy, active way?
I mean, it is. It depends how you travel. I mean, the many, many ways to travel. I think you can either travel comfortably, but you don't experience the sort of the actual sensations, the noise and the smell and the feel of places. And that's okay. You would get around, you see the world. To me, you've got to actually, there's got to be a sort of interaction between you and the places you go to. You've got to, it is a bit of a risk. And when I first traveled, you know, around the world in 80 days, I said, well, I don't speak any of these languages. What am I going to do? It's going to be embarrassing. And actually, it wasn't too bad because in the end, everybody will talk to you in some way or another. You can make some contact, but you have to make the effort yourself. Yeah. And what you get back from making that effort is something really rewarding. It's not someone telling you in a book, if you look at that building, it's built in the 16th century, take a picture and go on. It's saying, you know, you've discovered in that market somebody who, you know, his child is about the same age as your child, and, you know, you're going to sort of write them a letter or something like that in years to come. Those are important things.
And there's a phenomenon, you might call it. I'm sure you've heard, they call it the Palin effect, where places you visit and then spikes tourism.
Well, yeah, the places like the middle of the Sahara. Yeah. I don't think, you know, a spike would be two people instead of one going right. The year before. But yeah, now there's certain, and it's one of the best things about traveling is that I do occasionally get compliments from people who say, you know, because of you and watching your program, we went there, you know, yeah. And went somewhere quite difficult and we got a lot out of it. I remember, well, it doesn't always work. We were once bouncing in a bus across northern Sudan, and it was a terribly sort of, it was just a metal bus, and every time it bumped, your head went forward, your knees hit some bar and all that, and people were getting battered. Oh. And suddenly the two people in front turned around and said, "We're here because of you." So I felt, I apologized to them for the rest of the journey.
Sometimes it's a good effect, sometimes it's a painful effect.
But I don't think they were utterly complaining.
Now, where does Michael Palin still long to travel to and visit and see?
Well, you know, I wouldn't mind going back to some of the places I've already visited. I mean, I've been to some extraordinary places and odd places like the Kamchatkan Peninsula, which is in very eastern Russia, north of Vladivostok. Absolutely beautiful, unspoiled world. 25 active volcanoes in this world, you know, rivers full of salmon and all that. Wow, I'd love to go back there again and say, did I really see that? Then, you know, new places, I'm you know, Central Asia, I don't know anything about those, the big the stans, as they call them, Kyrgyzstan, all that. Because I think they're interesting because, you know, a lot of our history is of invasions from Central Asia, you know, whether it was Tamerlane going to India or sort of Kublai Khan going to China and the people who sort of sacked Rome, the Visigoths, they all came out of Central Asia. So I'm quite interested to know what that's like now, why they all wanted to leave and why they were such ferocious and very successful empire builders.
And do you have any particularly fond memories of traveling throughout Canada?
Yes, I have some very happy memories of traveling throughout Canada, and some less happy. But then, we did a Monty Python tour of Canada very early on when Python wasn't well known. But the Canadians have been big fans of Python, which we appreciated greatly. But our manager obviously had no sense of geography and thought that Canada was about the size of the Isle of Wight, you know, and you could just go to places in about a few hours, and didn't realise that doing a one-night stand in Toronto and then going on to Calgary was a bit of a long haul. So we did that. We were. I mean, nobody knew us terribly well. Saskatoon actually cancelled our visit for lack of interest.
Yeah. Oh my God.
Yeah. I can remember other times I've been through the Rockies. We travelled on when I did Full Circle right up from Vancouver right up to Alaska, and of course. My journey last year to the Northwest Passage was absolutely fascinating. Yeah. Really opened up Canada for me. Yeah. Flying, you know, if you fly up and gradually the land beneath gets less and less sort of green, and then the trees disappear altogether, and then there's just water and stone and gravel, and then God, ice. It's fantastic. You know, realize how big a country it is. What a big country.
And you celebrated your 75th anniversary, 75th birthday.
Yes.
In North Korea.
I did.
Right?
I did.
That
is something, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it is something.
That is quite something. I celebrated my 75th birthday in North Korea on a collective farm.
What? So what's a North Korean birthday party like?
Well, there wasn't really a party. I was working hard. When we were doing a sequence of me with this lady farmer, nice lady, but I was helping hoe the. They only have manual tools there, so we just helping prepare the furrows for the planting that was to come. And I was doing this and going on, and eventually I just said, "How am I doing?" And there's a bit of tossation. She said, "You're completely useless." So she's completely honest about it. But in the evening, in a little town called Wonsan on the far eastern shores of North Korea, they made me a birthday cake, a North Korean birthday cake.
Wow.
Yeah, and they put candles on it, and we had a few drinks, and it was all very, very, as happy as it would be anywhere else in the world. It was lovely.
Wow, that's so sweet.
Yeah, yeah.
You mentioned Monty Python earlier, and I know next year is the 50th anniversary, which a lot of people are asking what's going on, and from what I've been, Eric Idle has said that there isn't really anything planned.
Well, it's difficult. We've had many anniversaries, and yeah. I think we've done just about as many documentaries as we can possibly do. You know, I'm not sure there's another documentary in us. The last great thing we did, which was terrifically successful, was the concerts in London, the 10 concerts. And that was great, and I don't think we could ever produce anything as good as that. And you know, it's sad because Terry Jones has dementia, and would not, I don't think, be able to. To take part. Graham's dead, so it's just four of us, you know, and I don't know whether we will do something, I'm sure. We'll probably be rude about each other on public television.
What does it mean to you that people still care? Because, I mean, it's on Netflix. There's a whole new generation discovering Monty Python, so that they even care that it is the 50th anniversary. Mm. How does that feel for you?
Well, you should ask my accountant. He'd say, "This feels pretty good." No, we don't make a lot from it, but it is terrific that there's a generation now, and lots of people tell me, you know, a number of people said, "I've got a 9-year-old son. I just showed him Monty Python, The Life of Brian." I say, "You did what?" "Oh, and he thinks Biggest Dickus is the funniest thing he's ever heard." And I think, wow, you know, Biggest Dickus has survived three generations. And there are still people who laugh at it. That's good, you know. Yeah. I mean, what can you say? We're not forcing them to laugh. It's just out there, and if people respond to it like that, then I'm delighted in a way. I don't feel that my sense of humor has changed in any way or dated. The things I would laugh at now are probably the things I laughed at when I was in my 20s and writing Monty Python. And it's nice to be, to have that confirmed. That there are people now who will laugh at something that I did when I was 50 years ago, you know.
Yeah. It's quite a legacy and quite a gift to be able to give generations laughter.
Well, that is really,
Before we go, I wanted to ask you for maybe a bit of advice or two for any of our listeners or viewers or readers who are going to be traveling? Anything that maybe you've sort of learned over the years, or little tips or tidbits that you can advise?
Well, you know, never be afraid. I think there's a lot of fear of travel and going to places. And actually, every risk I've ever taken so far, I'm not don't quote me on this, I don't want any lawyers after me, but it's worth trying to go for somewhere which is slightly difficult. Never, ever take anyone else's word for a place. You've got to experience it yourself. You know, people say, don't go there, or you've got to go there. It's got to be something that you're interested in. So, I would imagine that probably the people who are interested in travel, who you talk to, are people who know a bit about the world, who read a bit about it, look at maps, plan trips. That's a good thing. Just do it for yourself and make sure it's your own personal thing. And if you have a dream, then go for it.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Mr. Palin, and congratulations on the book again.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Good interview, Mike.
Thanks. Yeah, that was a huge thrill, a personal thrill of mine. Every once in a while in this job, you get to meet people who are actually sort of heroes to you in real life, and he is one of them.
Did he disappoint, Mike?
No, he did not. He was wonderful. And after we went after we finished recording, we were talking for a little bit. And, you know, earlier on in my career here at Zoomer, I interviewed Terry Jones, another member of Monty Python, and he's now suffering from a form of dementia, and Michael Palin and he are sort of best friends, so we were talking about that. But Terry Jones was another example of somebody I met where just, you know, check that off the bucket list, a hero who did not disappoint. Such a wonderful, bright, funny, kind soul. And so Michael Palin gave us a bit of an update. He said, Terry's struggling. It's a difficult thing to deal with.
Yeah, that sucks.
But Michael Palin still goes and visits him, and their bond is as strong as ever. And Michael Palin was wonderful.
Did Michael Palin tell you where his love of travel came from?
Well, he actually, it's funny. He recounted.
Because I always wonder that, because I'm a kind of a home buddy. Only when I'm out and about, you have to really drag me to go on trips and big trips. But when I'm out and about, I love, I'll stay out there. Mm-hmm. I'll even extend trips. But was he talking about what drives him to?
Well, he's
even though I was there, I didn't quite, I missed some stuff.
He and I didn't talk about it, but he's written about it, how he would be in, grade school, basically. And you'd look at maps and atlases and such and learn geography. But it was really when he would go out on field trips with his class, whether be it on a long distance trip or even just somewhere in and around where he lived. But just the idea of getting out and visiting the places instead of just reading about them in books was what sparked his lifelong love of travel, which he also said in an interview, he said, he was 45 before he finally traveled the world.
Wow.
And not that, I'm sure he wouldn't want to trade his Monty Python years to travel more, but I mean, he has really made the most of it in the last 30 years because he just turned 75 this year.
Yeah. He looks amazing.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
And the fact that he still has the energy to do all this traveling. It's great.
Yeah. And he's actually traveled.
It brings you energy, really. New experiences in traveling the world, I would imagine.
Oh, my God. Your horizons are so broadened. And he was telling us how many different cities and countries he has to travel to for the book tour. Mm-hmm. And it's funny, he's doing more travel for the book tour than he did for the book. Mm. But I mean, it's nice to be in demand, right? After 30 years of doing something, people still want to see you.
Well, Mike, that was a great interview as always.
Yeah, I thank you, Gina. And I highly recommend checking out again. The name of the book is Erebus, One Ship, Two Epic Voyages, and the Greatest Naval Mystery of All Time. It's by Michael Palin. It's a fabulous read. Anybody I know who's read it could not put it down.
I can't wait to read it.
And I can attest to that. It's a wonderful, fun, enlightening read. It's available now, so anywhere you get books, you can find Erebus.
Okay, and again, follow us on everythingzoomer.com. The Ages and Icons podcast is there. What else? iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and now Spotify.
Yeah.
So thanks a bunch, everybody, and we'll see you soon.
Yeah, and thank you, of course, to Michael Palin for his time today. It was a pleasure. Thank you to Gina, as always, and to everyone listening, and we'll see you next time on Ages and Icons.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.